All right, this is Bio 241. It's Tuesday, August 26th. We're sort of in the middle of Chapter 2, Chemistry. And so if anybody has any questions over chemistry, that was a good time to ask over what we covered so far. But I could ask you some questions then. How many different kinds of subatomic particles are there? Three. What are they? Let's name them. Proton, electron, and neutron. Okay, and an atom has got two places where you can put these particles. What are the two places? Nucleus or? Orbitals. Another name for orbital is a shell. Now, who goes in a shell or an orbital? Not anybody can go in there. Only electrons. What particles can go into the nucleus? Protons and neutrons, right. Which one has a positive charge? Proton. Which one has a negative charge? Electrons, yeah. And the reason why we're paying attention to all this stuff is so that you can get a feeling for how different kinds of bonds work and how they're developed. And that will give you a feel for the strengths of these different kinds of bonds. And so where did we leave off last time? Did we cover covalent bonds?
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. For around ionic bonds. Okay, let me remind you, you got to make sure you know the first two columns of this table right here. It's not in your book, but these are important chemical or important elements that we have in our body, and this is the chemical symbol for those elements. So you got to be able to go back and forth. So what's a tricky one? If you don't study, which ones could you mix up real easy?
Sodium.
Because sodium starts with an S, and you might want to say S, but what is S? Sulfur. Okay. Calcium. Oh, potassium. Yeah, potassium. Oh, yeah, because potassium starts with a P, but P is phosphorus. Another one is iron. You might think that iron is I, but iron is not I. Iron is Fe. What is I? Iodine. Yeah, so you got to spend a little time memorizing those things. And, of course, you have to know how to use the periodic table in that you have to know what makes one element different from another, which is what? Atomic number. Right, the atomic number, that's just the number of protons inside the nucleus, and that's the number in the upper left-hand corner. Some periodic tables might have it in the bottom left-hand corner over here, but it's always the big number, and it never has any decimal points to it. It's always just an integer. Okay. So here is that nice covalent bond. What kind of bond is a covalent bond in terms of strength? It's the strongest. That's right. And then the next weakest is a ionic bond. So don't forget, when it comes to covalent bonds, the best way that we can talk about it is that the valence electrons, right, that's the electrons in the outermost shell. What can you tell me about the valence electrons in a covalent bond? How are they associated between two atoms? They're shared. That's right. Covalent bond is sharing of electrons. And an ionic bond, on the other hand, they're not shared. All right. One atom donates an electron and the other accepts that electron. And so hopefully we talked about this in class. Did we talk about this figure in class? Yeah, okay. So here you see, you know this is sodium because it has 11 protons. You look at the periodic table, sodium's got 11 over there, should have 11 electrons. And it does, so that means the first shell is completely filled up, that's 2. And then the second shell is completely filled up, that's another 8. So 8 plus 2 is 10, there's one electron left over. Sodium wants to get rid of that electron so that this outer shell is completely filled. And an atom that will accept that electron is chloride, or chlorine. And then so chlorine accepts that electron, and then the ultimate is that since sodium has lost an electron, it has a positive 1 charge, and since chlorine has accepted that, it becomes a minus 1 charge. And these elements that have a charge on them, what do we call these? Okay, what do we call this thing that has a plus 1 charge as opposed to this one over here? I'm not understanding what you're saying. Say that word once again. What are you saying? Oh, cation. Okay. Cation. Cation. Okay, cation. All right. And this other one is an anion. Yeah, very good. Okay, cation and anion. But that's pretty specific, which is really nice. But generally speaking, all right, so if this is a cation and this is an anion, that means they're different things. But there's another word that includes both of these together, doesn't separate them out by charge. It's called an ion. So these are all ions, and they have electrical charge on them. And an electrical charge in motion, what do we call an electrical charge in motion? That's an electrical current. Okay, that's an electrical current. And you have electrical currents in your body because these ions are moving around. So you are very electrical in nature because of these ions. And another general term for these ions, including potassium and calcium, chloride, magnesium that you have in your body, sometimes they are called electrolytes. Electrolyte. I think I put that on the board last time. And I think I told you, sometimes patients in the hospital might be, you might have some very serious electrical disturbances in their body because their electrolytes are not where they should be. A person has lost homeostasis or regulation of their electrolytes. And we have to get these levels determined very quickly. So somebody might yell out, I need some lights on this patient, stat. So what does that mean? If you need lights on a patient? Yeah, not, you don't go and get a lamp and shine it on somebody, but you go draw their blood and you get their blood analyzed for electrolytes. Okay, so here are a couple examples of electrolytes. Now, I saw kind of a confusing look on somebody's face over here. Did somebody have a question about what we were talking about so far? No? We're good? Okay, so those are two kinds of bonds, ionic bonds and covalent bonds. Oh, this is, I think, where we stopped. Yeah, okay, it's coming back to me. So, let's go back and look at this water molecule right here. And I think I described this on the board last time. All right, this oxygen is completely surrounded by all those electrons. Even the electrons from these hydrogen atoms right here are more in this region as opposed to this region over here. So if you look at a water molecule from far away, it looks neutral. But as you get close, depending on how you get close to this water molecule, it might have a little bit of a positive charge here. Or if you come from this direction, it has a little bit of a negative charge. So because of that, we say the water molecule has two different ends. It is what? It is one pole over here, which is negative, another pole over here that is positive. So it's polar in nature. Okay? It's polar in nature. So polar compounds will dissolve in water. Nonpolar compounds won't dissolve in water. So what is a polar kind of compound? Well, it's any kind of compound that has some kind of electrical charge on it. And what molecules or what atoms did we just look at have an electrical charge on them? Sodium, chloride, potassium, all of these ions, all of these electrolytes. So here is a really nice example. All right, when we make a sodium ion and a chloride ion, and it's not in solution. We just put these two atoms together. They will form a bond. And the reason is because this overall charge is positive, and this overall charge on the chlorine is negative, and opposite electrical charges attract each other. Like electrical charges repel each other. All right, so sodium and chloride, since they have opposite charge, they will attract each other. That will form an ionic bond. And when you have sodium and chloride that are dry, they form a nice sodium chloride crystal. All those ionic bonds are formed, and it forms just a really nice perfect crystal. And you're used to looking at it, because what's sodium chloride? It's just table salt, right? But that bond is so weak, so if you take sodium chloride and you put it in water, will it dissolve? Yeah, a lot of salt will dissolve in water. You can put just a lot of salt in water. A lot will dissolve in water, and why is that? And that's because water is a polar compound. It likes to be around other kinds of molecules that have a charge on them. And this is what we find. The ionic bond is so weak that when sodium chloride's crystal is put in water, the crystal will break down, the sodium and chloride will separate, and it will dissolve in water because part of the water molecule here The oxygen is what? Negative. It's going to be attracted by the cation. So this is what we call a hydration sphere. Water will order itself around the sodium because these negative charges will balance out that positive charge from that sodium. Chlorine will dissolve in water as well because why? Doesn't want to be close to the oxygen, but it wants to be close to these hydrogens right here because there's a little bit of a positive charge on the hydrogens. So they fit together very nicely. A lot of sodium and chloride will dissolve, right? Because it will form these hydration spheres around these ions. So any kind of charged particle or ion will dissolve in water very nicely. If we have a molecule that has no charge on it, in any part of the molecule, it won't want to dissolve in water. It just won't even recognize it. And compounds that don't have any charge on them are things like oil, gasoline, lipids in our body. And you're probably familiar with that, like butter is a nonpolar compound, has no charges on it whatsoever. So for instance, this morning if you're making some toast and you put some butter on it, slipped out of your hand and fell on your pants, how does it always fall? Butter side down. So you got this smudge of butter on your pants. Can you take a towel with water on it and just get that butter off your pants? It won't. And that's because butter is nonpolar and water is polar. They just won't ever mix with each other, no matter how hard you try. You have to use something called the soap. And I got a picture of what soap looks like in just a second. It will make really nice sense to you in just a second. Okay. So ionic bonds are very weak. Hydrophilic molecules are soluble in water. Hydrophilic just means in love with water. Hydrophilic molecules are polar. So hydrophilic and polar can be used interchangeably. Hydrophobic are molecules that don't like water, and those are polar, nonpolar kinds of molecules, like lipids, fats, oils, things of that nature, because they can't form hydration spheres. They just don't want to be around water. And last time I think I also talked about water. Is it a sticky compound or is it a slippery compound? Okay. A lot of people are going to say slippery, and I have to change your opinion on that. Okay. Because sure, if there's water on the floor and you step on it, if it's a linoleum floor, you're gonna slip, right? And hopefully not break your wrist or ankle or something, right? But essentially, because water is polar, it has these different areas of positive and negative charges, water is very sticky. If we look at water that's even in solution, that's a liquid, there's a lot of organization in water because you see just one water molecule right here? This end is negative. These ends here are positive. Well, the next water molecule is going to arrange itself so this positive end of this second water molecule is going to line up with the negative end of its neighbor all the way around. Okay, so here you can see the positive end of the first water molecule now is going to bond with the oxygen of the second water molecule. So even when water is in a liquid, there's a lot of structure because water molecules like to stick together. And these dotted lines right here represent what we call hydrogen bonds. These are bonds between different water molecules. These solid lines right here represent what kind of bond? What's water? What's the chemical symbol for water? H2O, right? H2 and then O. So here's one water molecule. And we actually built this molecule. What kind of bond is this right here? This is a covalent bond because one electron from this hydrogen atom is being shared with another electron from this oxygen right in this area here. So this is a strong covalent bond. Okay, this right here, this dotted line, is a very weak hydrogen bond. That's the third kind of bond. And that's the weakest one that we've talked about so far. It's very easy to break. But nonetheless, it's still there. And there can be so many little tiny hydrogen bonds that certain organisms can even walk on water because they're not heavy enough to push the water molecules aside and go kaplunk into a lake or a stream or something. Has anybody ever seen that? An animal walking right on the surface of the water? Like what? Like a little water spider. or insects and things like that can walk on water because water is so sticky, they can walk right on the surface of the water because of those hydrogen bonds. Now, you can't get away with that because we're too heavy, right? We can push, we can break those hydrogen bonds. That that property of water, where water molecules stick together, is called surface tension. And that has some real important physiologic implications. There's parts of your body where we want surface tension because it's going to act as a glue and hold things together. Other parts of your body, that surface tension has to be defeated so that there can be a separation of tissues under certain circumstances. And so we'll see how your body defeats surface tension. All right, the next topic, acids and bases. You're probably familiar with this somewhat. Your body is at 7.35. That's a pH. pH is a measure of acidity in your body. And the pH scale goes from 0 to 14. And what number is right smack in the middle? 7. All right. Is right here. So a pH of 7 is exactly neutral. So, and if that number gets greater than 7, it becomes basic. And the bigger the pH number is, the more basic it is. The smaller the number gets, the more acidic a water solution becomes. So pH 6 is more acidic than 7. pH 6 is what compared to pH 1? pH 6 is not as acidic, actually more basic, right? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. If you go in this direction, your body becomes more acidic. Okay. So an acid is a compound that will release protons in a solution. So we call it a proton donor. What the heck is a proton? You can tell me what I'm drawing here. Okay, so here is, here's an atom. What kind of atom is that? There's a plus one charge in the nucleus. There's a minus one charge in an orbital. So the atomic number of this element is 1. And if you look at the periodic table, what's 1? Oh, it's disappeared on that periodic table. But if you get close, you can see it. That's hydrogen. So here's a hydrogen atom. And if we take this electron away from a hydrogen atom, what are we left with? Just whatever in the nucleus, and what's in the nucleus? A proton. Okay? So another name for this proton right here, which is a hydrogen atom minus its electron, is a hydrogen ion. Right? It's an ion because why? It has that little charge right there. Okay, that's a hydrogen ion. So a hydrogen ion and a proton, how do they relate to each other? They're exactly the same thing, right? So we use these terms interchangeably, and if you haven't used these terms, it's kind of freaky to get used to it, I know. We use proton, but protons are very important in your body. They determine the reactivity of chemical reactions in your body, and this acidity has to be regulated. We are regulated to 7.35. Is that slightly acidic or slightly basic or is it neutral? Here's neutral, slightly basic. Okay, that's where we function. And if we were to eat a bunch of acid, like we do all the time, I had a Coke for lunch. The pH of Coke is way down over here, maybe about 1 or something. So I ingest all of this acid, you would think that our bodies would move from 7 to very acid. And if my pH or anybody's pH in here were to change from 7.35, let's go this other way, and it would drop to maybe 7.20, does that seem like a big change? Numerically, it doesn't look big, okay? But physiologically, it would probably kill you, okay? So pH has to be regulated. We'll see how your pH is regulated, but let's talk about what acids and bases really are for a second. So an acid releases what? Hydrogen ions or protons into solution. That's what an acid is. A base lowers hydrogen ion levels in a solution. So sometimes we call that a proton acceptor. It accepts protons from solutions as opposed to putting them into a solution. So here are some common acids and bases. Some of these are real important biologically. Hydrochloric acid isn't important biologically unless you get it on yourself. Okay, so you should be aware, sulfuric acid is an acid that you have in batteries, your car batteries. And you have to be concerned about these acids. Could you open up your car battery, stick your finger in it, and swish it around and see if it's dissolved properly? No, because you pull your finger out, and what would happen? You would be missing part of it. Okay, it would be all burned. So the acidity or alkalinity of a solution determine a lot of chemical properties. Okay, one important acid in your body is phosphoric acid. You see that? What does this P stand for? Phosphorus, and then these oxygens right here. Nitric acid is not so important biologically, but carbonic acid is. So you should probably be familiar with his chemical formula right here. Carbonic acid is H2CO3, and the CO3 basically comes from CO2, which our body produces all the time. So why are these acids? Well, because if we have hydrochloric acid, which is HCl, and we put this in water, it breaks down completely into, what's that? Hydrogen ion, or you can say proton, plus a chlorine ion. Breaks down 100%. So it's donating these protons to the water solution. Do these things dissolve in water very easily? And why? Because they have these little charges on them, right? They're polar in nature. They dissolve in a polar solvent very easily. Let's look at another compound. Instead of an acid, let's talk about sodium hydroxide. Here's the formula right here. Sodium hydroxide, NaOH, it breaks down completely into OH minus plus sodium ion. And this guy, you have to know what you call that ion too. That's a hydroxyl ion. Or hydroxide. Hydroxide ion from here. So that's a base. Now, why do we call that a base? What's the definition of a base? It's a proton acceptor. So why do we call this a proton acceptor? Because what can we do? If we have an H plus, which is an acid, that's a proton, and a hydroxide ion, what do we have if we combine a proton with a hydroxide? Little magical H2O. Okay, and in this particular case, if we add exactly equal amounts of acid and base together, what happens? They neutralize each other, right? That goes to pH 7, and what do you get out of it? Water. Okay, so that's some things about acids and bases. So you got to know these definitions right here. Okay. Now here is some terminology that we use to talk about acids and bases, and this is the pH scale. So this is one of the last things about pH that we're going to be talking about. So pH is a measure of the hydrogen ion concentration. What does that mean? Because what is this right here? This is a hydrogen ion, right? This is a hydrogen ion or a proton. But a pH is a measure of this hydrogen ion concentration. Sometimes we symbolize this, right? So H plus is hydrogen ion. And if we want to say hydrogen ion concentration without writing out concentration, because it's got a lot of letters, we just put some brackets around it. That means hydrogen ion. And what does this mean? Concentration, right? Hydrogen ion concentration. So you see a little equation right here, and probably none of us are really familiar with this equation, but this is the equation. pH is equal to the log of 1 over the hydrogen ion concentration. So if you know what the hydrogen ion concentration is with your calculator, if you know how to use the log button, you can calculate the pH. Okay. So pure water is neutral. It has a pH of 7. Okay, and we talked about this. Acids are from 0 to 7, and bases are from 7 to 14. All right, let me erase some of the board here. I'll just kind of give you a little inkling where that pH 7 comes from. All right, so pH equal to 7, what does that mean? Acid or basic? Neutral, right? So we say neutral. It's neutral. And what neutral means is that the concentration of hydrogen ions is equal to the concentration of hydroxide ions in solution. They're exactly equal at pH 7. And the concentration is exactly at pH 7, 1 times 10 to the minus 7th molar. That's just the number of particles that are in a solution, or moles per liter. And you see this little number in the exponent right here, times 10 to the minus 7? When you put it into that equation, it automatically turns out to be 7. It's minus 7 up over there, but since we take the inverse of it in this equation, it turns out to be a positive 7. So what does that number really look like? It's 0 point, what? It's small. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, okay, and then 7. So it's a really small number. What about 1 times 10 to the minus 6? Minus just means it's to the right of the decimal point. What kind of number is that? Is it bigger or smaller? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's bigger. It's 10 times bigger. But if it's 10 times, it's 1 times 10 to the minus 6, what's the pH? It's not 7 anymore. It's 6. Okay, so that will produce a pH of 6. All right, well, let's take a couple jumps. Let's say 1 times 10 to the minus 1. Is that a bigger number than times 10 to the minus 7 or smaller? Yeah, right? It's 0.1. So that's a lot bigger number than these right here. And this pH, when you stick it into that equation, this number, when you stick it into that equation, what does that turn out to be? pH of 1. Okay? So that's why as the hydrogen ion concentration gets bigger and bigger and bigger, what happens to the pH number? It gets more acidic, but which way does it go? Does it get bigger or smaller? 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. That's the tricky thing that you have to become familiar with in terms of pH. As the hydrogen ion concentration increases, what happens to the pH number? It gets smaller. It goes in an opposite direction because of that funny equation that we use to describe pH. Okay, so as the hydrogen ion concentration increases, does it become more acidic or less acidic? As the hydrogen ion concentration increases, it becomes more acidic. But what happens to the pH number? Goes down, goes the opposite way. Okay, so that's something you have to be a little familiar with. And you want to do just a real quick little test? Not for credit, just for fun. I don't want to be messing with your heart rates right now. So let's put a couple solutions on the board real quick. And you should be able to tell me if it's neutral or acidic or basic. Okay? And what's going to determine that? The hydrogen ion concentration compared to the hydroxide ion concentration. All right? So here we have a beaker. We got water in there. We got a couple protons in solution, some hydroxide ions. What's the pH of that solution? Exactly 7, because it's the same number of hydrogen ions and hydroxide ions, exactly equal, pH 7. All right, what about this beaker right here? Don't tell me right now, because I'm going to try to trick you. What's that, neutral, acidic, or basic? It is, I see two hydrogen ions, but I see three hydroxide ions. And since there's more hydroxide than hydrogen, it's got to be basic. Neutral. And then our last beaker over here, let's do this. I'm going to put it like that. Is that neutral, acidic, or basic? It's acidic because there are a lot more hydrogen ions in solution than hydroxide ions. That's what makes it acidic. You can't tell me the number, but at least you can tell me which way things are going. So which one has the lowest pH number? The one on the right-hand side, the middle, or the left-hand side? The right-hand side has the lowest number, even though what? It has the highest hydrogen ion concentration. That's how the pH scale works. So you got to look at that a number of different ways to become familiar with it. People that use the pH scale, don't ever get it mixed up because it makes perfect sense. But when you're first starting to look at it, it seems screwy, but it works really well. Okay? That's pH. Okay, so I said we could kill ourselves by eating acid, but we don't. Why is that? Because there are special compounds in our body that will resist a change in pH even when we add acids to our body or even if we add bases to our body. If we eat bases or we eat acids, our pH doesn't change. And those chemical compounds are called buffers. All proteins are buffers. And there are some important buffer systems in the body like the bicarbonate, the one that's based on carbonic acid right here. All right. If we put hydrogen ions in our body, these little things can't translate into PowerPoint very well. These are supposed to be an arrow that's pointing in this direction and the same arrow that can point in the other direction. So that's a bidirectional arrow. Put that in your lecture notes right here. Just kind of scratch that off. And I would write it on here, but then it wouldn't go away. So just a bidirectional arrow. These chemicals can go backwards and forwards. So here's a chemical equation. Yeah? Oh, you do? Good. It depends on the printer if it has the correct fonts to point you, okay? So if you have it, photocopy it for everybody. No, I'm just kidding. Okay. Yeah, you don't have the arrows. That's too bad. But you could put the arrows in there. Okay, so in this particular case, there's bicarbonate in our bodies. If we eat acid, that acid will combine with bicarbonate and form carbonic acid, and then that can form CO2 and water. Water is real easy to deal with in our body, and that CO2 we can just breathe out. So we can excrete acids just by exhaling. That's kind of nice. There are other buffer systems. Like I said, all proteins in your body. We have a lot of phosphate in our body. That is an important buffer system. So we can consume a lot of acid without changing our pH. And that's really good because that pH determines all the chemical reactions in our body. Okay, so a buffer can maintain pH under two circumstances, either when an acid is introduced to your body or a base. Either one is going to resist a change in pH. And I think I'd like to mention that because a buffer doesn't neutralize an acid, because what neutralizes an acid? A base neutralizes an acid. So you don't have to have a bunch of base in your body to neutralize an acid if you were to consume it. Right? That's a different kind of concept. A buffer will just absorb hydrogen ions or hydroxide ions when you consume them or when they're produced in your body under normal circumstances. Okay? And so that's why, I erased it. 7.35, we're pretty much rock steady at 7.35, just like your body temperature pretty much is rock steady at 98.6. And if it changes, there are homeostatic mechanisms that are going to make adjustments so that your pH does not change. Okay. Blood pH. Yeah, if it's less than 7.35, that's acidosis, right? As the pH number gets smaller, it becomes acidic. A pH number of greater than 7.5, we call that alkalosis, and patients can be in these kinds of conditions under certain circumstances. Okay. Organic molecules. All right, so here's another topic. This is kind of a fun topic. There are a number of important organic molecules in your body, and you have a lot of other kinds of molecules that are not organic, but are just as important biologically as organic molecules. But you don't have any idea probably right now what I'm talking about because we haven't defined what an organic molecule is, unless you go to a farmer's market or something and buy organic food. But that's a totally different topic, okay, and I don't know where it came from, but it's not very scientific, okay? Organic compounds are compounds that contain a carbon atom covalently bond to a hydrogen atom. So you got to have those two atoms joined together by a covalent bond. You could have hundreds or thousands of those. It's still an organic compound. And any kind of molecule that does not have that covalent bond between a hydrogen and a carbon is an inorganic molecule. So let's consider some molecules. And you tell me if they're important biologically. What about H2O? Is that important? Yeah. That's the most common molecule in your body. Is it organic? Nope. It's inorganic because it doesn't contain carbon. It contains hydrogen, but no carbon, so it can't be organic. Another important biological molecule is CO2. This is what we excrete from our bodies as a gas. Is that organic? Let's see. Look at the definition. What does it got to have? Carbon and hydrogen. What's it missing? Hydrogen. It's inorganic. So you're a factory producing CO2, and it's producing an inorganic molecule. Okay, which makes me wonder, in a farmer's market, they sell organic stuff, vegetables, but they never sell inorganic. It's either organic or not organic. Okay, that's sort of interesting. Okay, so what about an important organic kind of molecule? Here we have a molecule we call hexane. We see what? What's this at? This is carbon, covalently bond to a hydrogen. That solid line means that it's a covalent bond. And let's quickly say, what kind of bond is a covalent bond in terms of electrons? It's what? How would you say that with one word? Those electrons are being shared, right? So that's sharing of electrons in that valence shell, the outer shell. So this is an organic compound, hexane. It's not important biologically. Our bodies don't produce this. We don't run into it at any time except the chemistry lab, and then it's probably pretty toxic. It's probably carcinogenic and all that kind of stuff. So you don't want it in your body. It's organic, but I wouldn't buy it in a farmer's market because it's toxic. Okay, and so this is a nice organic compound. Do you see any positive charges or negative charges on it anywhere? It has no, so this is what we call a non-polar compound. It's not anything like water, because water is polar. Could we take hexane and have it dissolve in water? What is water like? Polar chemicals, hydrophilic chemicals. This one here is nonpolar. It's hydrophobic. It's sort of like an oil, right? But we don't call it that. We call it organic. That organic compound can bend, fold back on itself, and form this ring structure, right? So these are nice covalent bonds right here. That carbon is the carbon up over there, and there's two hydrogen ions bound to it. So this is sort of a long form of how we write it out. Easier way to write it out would just be like this, and then we just ignore the hydrogen ion sticking out of here, but we just know that there should be two hydrogen atoms sticking off of it. That's how we would symbolize hexane. When it's in a cyclic form, we would call that cyclohexane. Sometimes instead of just a single bond between carbons, sometimes instead of sharing one pair of electrons, you can share two pair of electrons, and we call that a double bond. And in which case, then one of these hydrogens has to disappear, go someplace else. And these double lines right here just represent a double bond. And so we see three positions where there are double bonds, so we lose hydrogens in those locations. And that chemical's got a different name, benzene. And again, is this an organic compound? Yep, because it's got carbon and hydrogen. Not important biologically. Again, it's toxic. It's carcinogenic. Even though it's organic, you wouldn't buy it at a farmer's market because it would be harmful to you. And again, this kind of molecule doesn't dissolve in water because it is nonpolar. You don't see any charges on it anywhere. Okay, so those are some organic molecules. So we have a long carbon backbone bound to these carbon atoms. We can modify those long carbon backbones by adding functional groups to them. And instead of a hydrogen, we can't, and this one here, this carbon normally would have, what, a hydrogen up over here and a hydrogen coming down like this. But those hydrogens are gone. We have a double bond to an oxygen. We call this a carbonyl functional group. It can be modified, instead of a carbonyl, it can be modified to a hydroxyl group. These will have different chemical properties in your body. And a hydroxyl group is a, what, an OH? Or we can have a sulfhydryl group. That S is one of the chemical compounds that I want you to know. That's what? Sulfur. Okay. This sulfhydryl group allows hair to have curls in it. So this is a very common kind of functional group that we have on certain proteins in our body. If we have a nitrogen, we call that an amino group. And amino acids have... amino acid. What's in that term, amino acid? Amino, right? This right here, that means that there's a nitrogen group in all amino acids. And what are amino acids a building block for? This you probably know before you take a physiology class. Yeah, protein, right? Amino acid has this kind of functional group in it. Another kind of functional group is a carboxyl group. At the end of a long carbon chain, it's a C, two oxygens, and a H right here, CO2H. This means that it's an acid, because when we put this kind of compound in water, this hydrogen here likes to hop off and become a proton donor. That means that it's going to add hydrogen ions to solution. It's going to add these hydrogen ions to solutions, and so it's very acidic in nature. Carboxyl group. And lastly, we have a phosphate group. So a phosphate, when we talk about phosphate in this class, usually we don't talk about just a single atom of phosphate, but a phosphate group is what? A PO4. You see four oxygens right there? And that is acidic as well, because these hydrogens have a tendency to come off, dissociate from the hydroxyl group. And when that hydrogen comes off, where does it go? It becomes a hydrogen ion in solution. So a phosphate group is acidic in nature as well. Okay, so probably next time we'll start working with some of these functional groups in class. All right, so this would be an organic acid. This would be an organic acid. All right, these are not acidic right here, but this would be an example of an alcohol type group. Okay. All right, so the first kind of important organic molecule that's important biologically, and at the very beginning of your notes for this chapter, I listed them for you. There's four major kinds of organic compounds. There's carbohydrates. Oh. Stereoisomers?
Yeah.
I'm not going to talk about it. I guess. I don't have it here. But I'll tell you. Here we have a molecule. This one. Notice that on this part of the molecule, we have the hydroxide, these hydroxyl groups pointing off to the right, and up over here we have it pointing to the left. Well, we could take this molecule and do what? We could flip it, and it would be a different molecule. So that would be a different isomer, even though it has the same chemical formula. All right, so it's either called a D or L isomer. And so you have two hands, right? And they're pretty much identical, but they're not really. Right? Because in anatomical position, if we superimpose them, we see that the thumbs are on opposite sides of your hand, depending if it's a right hand or left hand. So that's what we call a stereoisomer, and they're not exactly equal in biology. All right, so that's what a stereoisomer is. So there's a D form and an L form, just like you have a right and left hand. In terms of chemistry, they're not exactly equal. And only one is used in your body. Okay, so that's just stereoisomers. I don't think I will ever test you on stereoisomers. Okay, so you can delete that one. Okay. Well, anyway, the four kinds of important organic molecules that you have are carbohydrates, lipids, proteins, and lastly, nucleic acids. Now, there are other kinds of important organic molecules, but those are the major categories, carbohydrates, and you can see, is a carbohydrate an organic or inorganic compound?
Organic.
It's organic. You got the carbon, you got hydrogens, you got some hydroxyl groups right there. Okay. It's not an acid because this is not a carboxyl group, right? That's just a carbonyl group hanging off the end of the molecule right there. But why do we call these carbohydrates? Well, when they first started looking at, what's another common name for carbohydrate? For carb is a? Yeah, that's not what I'm looking for, but we're going to talk about that. It's a sugar, okay? Okay, so the people were starting to look at sugars and they would break it apart and they found for every carbon atom, for every carbon, they would find that there were two hydrogens on a carbon and an oxygen. And so they go, oh, well, gee whiz, I know what H2O is. What's that?
Water.
So they call this molecule, right? It would repeat itself a number of times, right? That's a carbon hydrate. So a carbohydrate is a carbon hydrate. It just is a carbon that has these other groups on them. So a carbohydrate, for instance, if it's a carbohydrate that has six carbons on it, we would erase this N and put what over here? Six. And we can erase the parentheses by doing what? Put a six here, and then 2 times 6 is 12, and then 6 times 1 over here is 6. So C6H12O6 is a typical six carbon sugar, and an example of a typical six carbon sugar is glucose, very important six carbon sugar in your body. But there are different isomers of these six carbon sugars. Here's another one, galactose. Notice that these hydroxyl groups are in different positions. This one right here, it's flipped over to the other side, but it still has what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 carbons in it, but a little bit different shape. So we give it a different name. This is galactose. And just like that hexane that we saw could form cyclohexane, these sugars are long enough they can bend back on themselves and form this cyclic form as well. All right, so I'm not ever going to ask you to tell me if this is galactose or glucose, but you should be able to tell me that is a carbohydrate. That's a sugar. That's what kind of, how many carbons? A six-carbon carbohydrate. Okay. Here is another six-carbon. It's a little bit different because we have this carbonyl group over here. It forms a little bit of a different ring structure. And this is fructose. This is what we find in fruit. So it's called fructose. All right. So it's a lot of stuff is actually named the way it should be. Right, so a lot of stuff isn't, but in this particular case, that's helpful. So these right here are the basic building blocks of carbohydrates. Okay, and another name for a carbohydrate is a saccharide. So we only have one building block in each one of these things here, so each one of these are what we call monosaccharides. We can put a couple monosaccharides together, and guess what we get? A disaccharide. We can put maybe all three of these together and get a trisaccharide out of them. And actually, we can put thousands of molecules. This is what happens in real life. We can put thousands of molecules of glucose together to form one molecule, but thousands of glucoses, and that's what we call starch. So starch really is what? It's a sugar. Okay. Give me some examples of starch that you have in your diet. Potatoes, rice, almost pure starch, bread, because it comes from wheat. So anything that has wheat, made out of wheat, tortillas, pasta, that's sugar because it's starch. Okay, and starch is a form that plants make, and it's a storage form of glucose. So somebody that has trouble regulating their blood glucose concentration, what's the name of that disease? Diabetes mellitus. They probably have to be really careful about how much starch they eat because it's like eating what? A candy bar, right? Okay. All right, so all of those are what we call monosaccharides. So here are a couple other names. Sucrose is a glucose plus one fructose. That's what plants like to make. Sugar cane, sugar beets, et cetera, et cetera. Make that fructose, and it's put together to make sucrose. Lactose is a glucose and a galactose. These are the building blocks of that disaccharide right there. And it takes a special enzyme to break that bond. And I suppose I could tell you how we like to name enzymes right now. Okay. It's really easy. We like to take the substrate, and that is the compound that an enzyme will work on, in this particular case, lactose, and we change the name, the suffix over here, and we like to put an A-S-E on the end of the word, and that means that it's not the molecule that's being worked on, it's the enzyme that makes something happen. So that enzyme would be called instead of lactose, it would be called lactase. That's the enzyme that breaks down lactose. What's an enzyme that breaks down maltose? That would be maltase, for instance. Okay, or sucrase, okay, breaks down sucrose. And when we get to the digestive system, I'll talk more about that, because I can't talk about everything fun in the first couple of lectures. Okay, glucose. If we add two glucoses together, you get maltose. These are all what kind of saccharides? Disaccharides. They're all disaccharides. And the basic building block of a disaccharide is a monosaccharide. Give me a specific name of a monosaccharide. Glucose. Okay, so that's how you would think about all of these things. Polysaccharides. The basic building block is a monosaccharide. And for starch and animal starch, which is what we call glycogen, we store glucose in our bodies in a form very similar to starch, but it's a little bit different. The branching pattern is a little bit different. We call it glycogen. It is made out of glucose. So it's a storage form of glucose. And if somebody is not diabetic, when their blood glucose starts to drop, their body puts glucose back in the blood. It gets it from the liver. Because in the liver, what is it? What does the liver contain? It contains glycogen, and so there are enzymes that will break glycogen down one monosaccharide at a time and put that and the basic building block of glycogen is glucose, put it in the blood, so that will maintain your blood glucose levels even when you're in a fasted state. So that comes from the liver. Okay, so let's talk about a chemical reaction. Because chemistry, you learn the definition of anatomy and physiology. Chemistry is the study of chemical compounds, but also it's the study of the reactions that they undergo. So it's those two things, the formulas of chemicals and the reactions. So let's look at a reaction. Here we have a monosaccharide, namely glucose. You could only tell because it's labeled here. I'm not going to ask you to know that this is a glucose, but this is some kind of monosaccharide. Here is another monosaccharide right here, two separate molecules. We can put them together to form maltose, right, just like we defined on the previous slide. And we're going to use a specific kind of reaction. Notice when we put these two molecules together, these two hydroxyl groups become very close to each other. And what can happen is that an OH group from one monosaccharide can be pulled off, and a hydrogen ion from the second monosaccharide can be pulled off and joined together. So what do you get when you join together? I erased it. A hydroxide ion and a hydrogen ion, you put them together, you get?
Water.
You get water out of it. All right, so here you get the resulting disaccharide joined with this one remaining oxygen and one molecule of water. So you're pulling water out of these two monosaccharides to form maltose. We call that a dehydration synthesis reaction. Can you see it's dehydration? It's pulling water out. Dehydration. And we're synthesizing this compound, so it's called dehydration synthesis reaction. In chemistry, we like to refer to that as a condensation reaction, but typically in biochemistry, we don't say condensation so often. We just say dehydration synthesis. We can also make a sucrose molecule by doing what? Exactly the same thing. Pulling off a hydroxide ion and a hydrogen ion right here, forming water. So what would we call this reaction? Yeah, that's a dehydration synthesis reaction, making this disaccharide. And as a matter of fact, if we wanted to take thousands of these glucose molecules to make a big, what kind of molecule? Glycogen or starch. What kind of reaction would we use? a dehydration synthesis reaction, but not one, but what? Thousands of times over to make that one big molecule. So this is a real handy reaction. And it's one of the most important reactions in the body because not only carbohydrates undergo this reaction, but so do proteins. What's a building block of a protein? Amino acid. And when we put amino acids together, what kind of reaction actually works to put amino acids together? We haven't studied it, haven't told you, but if I ask you to take a wild guess, okay, protein synthesis is what it's called, but the exact reaction when we put amino acids together is exactly the same as when we put monosaccharides together. It's going to be a dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay, and even when we make lipids, we put building blocks of lipids together. Guess what kind of reaction is going to be? Dehydration synthesis reaction. So essentially, these reactions are used over and over and over again. Okay, well, there are times, for instance, when we have maltose, we want to break maltose down into these two glucoses. All right, so we have maltose. What else do we need to break maltose apart? So we're going to go in the reverse direction. We don't have a slide in your book, but let's digest maltose down into its basic building blocks, which are two glucoses. What else? What other molecule do we need? We need water to do that. And when we use a water molecule to break this bond between the two glucoses and maltose, we call that a hydrolysis. Hydrolysis. Lysis is the breaking apart. Hydro is water. The breaking apart of water will break apart maltose to give you these two glucose molecules. That's the digestion of maltose. If we wanted to digest sucrose to make one fructose and one glucose molecule, what kind of reaction would we use? We would take a water, break it apart, stick one half on the fructose, the other part on glucose that will split sucrose. Right? Again, that would be a hydrolysis reaction. If you have a big protein with different amino acids and you want to break these amino acids apart, guess what kind of reaction you use? Hydrolysis reaction. You need water. So water is pretty interesting because not only is it the solvent that we're dissolved in, but it also participates in almost all the chemical reactions in your body. It's kind of freaky that it's that way. It just kind of just works. That's how things have evolved. All right, so carbohydrates is the first kind of organic compound. Next kind of organic compound is a lipid. These are insoluble in polar solvents like water because lipids don't have any charge on them unless they're a special kind of lipid that we're going to look at. So since they can't dissolve in water, since they have no electrical charges, we call them hydrophobic, and they consist primarily of long hydrocarbon chains, and chains can form cyclic structures. Okay, so we can store long carbohydrate chains in a special form. Let's see how our body can store some of these things. So here we have a long hydrocarbon chain. You see any charges right here? None whatsoever, right? So this means that this particular molecule can't dissolve in water. But on the end, we have a CO2H that's a carboxyl group. So this hydrogen likes to dissociate. So this is an acid because that hydrogen ion will end up in solution. Oh, I erased it. Will end up in solution. Will donate protons to solution. What do we call a compound that donates protons to a solution? That's an acid. So this is an acid because this is a carboxylic acid group. It's donating protons to a solution. So this thing right here, that's a long hydrocarbon chain with a carboxyl group on the end, that's what we call a fatty acid. And you probably heard of fatty acids before, and this is sort of what they look like. So here we have three fatty acids. We can combine them with another molecule. This one right here is a little strange because it looks partly like an alcohol, but kind of also like a carbohydrate, but not in every carbon right here. So this is kind of a mixture between a carbohydrate and an alcohol. We call it glycerol, but it has three carbons. And these three OHs, these positions right here, each position can bind one fatty acid. And how would we combine a fatty acid with this glycerol at this position? It's a dehydration synthesis reaction, right? So you pull out an OH and an H, that's H2O, and here you got H2O, but three of them because each one of these positions can bind one fatty acid. So if we bind these three fatty acids to glycerol, we call that a triglyceride. Has anybody ever heard of a triglyceride? It's measured in blood all the time, right? Because it gives you a measure of your lipid metabolism. And lipid metabolism is real important because we're concerned about cardiovascular disease. So triglyceride should be within a normal range within your blood. So that's basically a triglyceride. And if we want to break a triglyceride down to get fatty acids, what kind of reaction do we use? We need to put water in to break these bonds, right? We got to break water. What do we say when we break water? That's hydrolysis is breaking down. That's a hydrolysis reaction. So we have three hydrolysis reactions to break a triglyceride down into its building blocks. And you got to know the building blocks of a triglyceride. It's what? One glycerol and three fatty acids. So just like when somebody asks you what's a building block of a protein, you just say, oh, amino acid, right? For a triglyceride, it's what? Oh, you can't say amino acid. You say three fatty acids and glycerol. That's the building block. So that's a little memorization there, but you should get a feel for these reactions. Okay. Here are some examples of some fatty acids. This carboxyl group means that it's acidic in nature because this hydrogen atom can come off the carboxyl group and add itself to water as a hydrogen ion. So this one right here, if you count the carbons, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, is it 16? And I don't have this memorized, but a 16 carbon length fatty acid is what we call palmitic acid. You don't have to know that, but you should probably at least know that this is a fatty acid because you see the carboxyl group right here. We call this a saturated fatty acid because at every carbon, I don't see any double bonds, every carbon atom has two hydrogens bound to it. So it's completely saturated. Every carbon has two hydrogen atoms. Here is another kind of fatty acid. We call it linoleic because you see some of the carbon atoms here only have one hydrogen, but those electrons that would be used to bind another hydrogen are shared between neighboring carbons. So this is a double bond. So a fatty acid that has double bonds in it, we call unsaturated. It doesn't have two hydrogens for every carbon in this backbone. Nonetheless, it's still a fatty acid because of the carboxyl group right here. Okay, ketone bodies. I don't think I'm going to talk about these at all. Other than when we metabolize fatty acids for energy, they're broken down two carbons at a time, and then they're combined together sometimes. So here I see four carbon atoms. They can produce acetone and acetoacetic acid. And for instance, when somebody can't use sugar in their metabolism for energy, for instance, like a diabetic, these compounds will be produced because a diabetic is going to try to get energy from fatty acids, and these things are very volatile. You can even smell, you know what acetone smells like. How would you have acetone around the house?
Nail polish
remover, right? Okay. So sometimes diabetics will have, if it's not controlled, which is really too bad, will have that kind of scent on their breath. Okay. Acetone and acetoacetic acid is not as nice smelling as acetone. Okay, here is another important molecule. This is an exam figure. I think everything I showed you is an exam figure so far, right? Each one of these things. We're going to start going over these next time, I think, pretty quickly. But here we have a phospholipid. So it's a lipid. It's like a triglyceride. What's the building block of a triglyceride again? Glycerol and three fatty acids. So when we look at this, you see a glycerol anywhere. Here's a glycerol. 1, 2, 3. That's a three-carbon glycerol. And this thing right here with this carboxyl group joined right here, this is a fatty acid. And each one of these squiggles, each one apex here and here and here, that represents a carbon atom. So this is just a very long hydrocarbon chain. That's a fatty acid. Here's a second fatty acid in the second position on glycerol. But in this third position right here, okay, we don't have a fatty acid. What do we have bound to this third position on glycerol? We have a phosphate group, an inorganic phosphate, a PO4 group. So this is what? This is acidic in nature because this really is what? An OH group, and the hydrogen has come off, and it's a little bit of an acid. Okay, but there's also this amino group over here, this nitrogen. And what do you see on this nitrogen? Is it polar or nonpolar?
Polar.
It's polar. So this is a really interesting molecule because these are really long parts of it right here. What's the nature of this part right here? Is it polar or nonpolar?
Mm-hmm.
It's nonpolar. So it's hydrophobic, doesn't like to be with water. But this other end of the molecule, which is not quite as big, but almost as big, you see these charges, so that means it is hydrophilic. So here is a really interesting molecule. Part of it likes to be in water, and part of it doesn't like to be in water. And it seems like that's kind of confusing, but we're going to see that that is the basis of how life evolved on our planet. All right, this is an amazing molecule. All right, so if we were to represent this molecule in a more diagrammatic form, even, we can see, oh, I'm losing my cursor. I guess I got to get closer. The batteries are dying. Okay, so this group right here represents the phosphate group and this amino group right here, which is what? Polar. So we call this a head group, usually. And then these long fatty acid chains right here, nonpolar, hydrophobic, sometimes these are called tails. I don't know why they don't call them legs because there's two of them. But these are the hydrophobic tails. And here is the hydrophilic head group. And so since this is a lipid plus this phosphate group, we call it a phospholipid. And it has both natures to it. And these natures are very important as to whether they're like to dissolve in water or not dissolve in water. So let's take a look at this. And maybe you could tell me what I'm drawing. Okay, what's that? Yeah, it kind of looks like a stomach. I didn't draw it so good. Oh, that's better. That's a salad dressing bottle. That's in your refrigerator, okay? So it's filled up to here, but is this, it's been in the refrigerator for a long time, is this all homogeneous, or what's inside the salad dressing bottle? What do you notice?
Oil.
You have oil and water, and are they all mixed together, or what? They're all separated. So you see a line right here. What's up on the top? You got the oil on the top, and you got the water down over here. And do you pour this on your salad just as it's pulled out of the refrigerator? No, because you'd only get oil. And all the spices, all the salts and sugars and stuff are in the water because those are all hydrophilic compounds, right? So what do you do before you pour it on your salad? Got to shake it up and mix it all up, okay? And then when you put it in the refrigerator and come back the next day, what do you see? It's all separated again. So did you have to do anything special to get it separated?
No.
It just happens automatically. That separation happens automatically because of what? There's nonpolar parts and there are polar parts to it. So things just automatically separate out by their nature. All right, well, let's take that phospholipid. What does a phospholipid look like? It's a head group, which is polar, and these tails over here, which are nonpolar, and we're going to stick one molecule in the salad dressing bottle, and where is it going to go? Is it going to go in the oil? Or is it going to go in the water? Or is it going to like get stuck up on the top? Right here. Interesting. A little tricky. Not too bad. But what part is this over here? This is the philic part. This is the phobic part. So the philic part is going to go right here. And the phobic part is going to go where? Won't go down. It's going to go up into the oil. And did you have to do anything to take that one molecule and stick it exactly in that location right there? Automatically happens all by itself. But now instead of one molecule, let's stick millions of molecules in there, or thousands. I won't draw all million of them out, but a couple of them. Where are they going to go? Just like this right here. And did you have to do anything special to get all of these molecules to line up exactly like that?
No.
Automatically. So what we've actually done right here is that we formed part of a biological membrane. So membranes like to just assemble themselves automatically, just according to the physical properties of the molecule, because it has two different natures. It's got a phobic part and a hydrophilic part. Membranes self-assemble. And let's see what the next slide is. So that's an exam figure. I want you to be able to identify that as a phospholipid. All right. And if we take, instead of this salad dressing bottle right here, if we take a beaker that just has water in it, no oil whatsoever, and stick a bunch of phospholipids in it, this is what's going to happen. These hydrophobic parts of a phospholipid have no place to run and hide to get away from water, unless they can come together and form an environment in the middle of all themselves, which is hydrophobic. And on the outside, the hydrophilic part is going to associate with water. So it forms this little thing that kind of looks like a, what does that kind of remind you of? Maybe a cell. Okay, so membranes will automatically form, phospholipids will automatically form little pockets or vesicles or cells just because of the hydrophobic and hydrophilic nature. And you can see how water is oriented around the polar head group. So membranes like to just assemble themselves. That's called a micelle. And micelles are being used in important ways because we can actually take drugs that are hydrophobic and have them put into micelles like that and administer them to patients. That's kind of interesting. All right, another kind of steroid, not a fatty acid based, but it looks kind of like a stair step right here. There's a step here and then another step over here. This is what cholesterol looks like. And is cholesterol a harmful molecule or a helpful molecule in your body? And you know what? That's right. It all depends. If you have the right amount, it's perfect. If you have too much, that's bad because it will produce cardiovascular disease, can plug up vessels, produce vessel disease. But notice that this structure, you won't have to tell me that this is cholesterol and this is a hormone called cortisol, and here's another hormone called testosterone, here's another hormone called estradiol. These are sex hormones right here that regulate sexual reproduction in humans. All right, so these hormones are all built from cholesterol. So if you don't have the right level of cholesterol in your body, your body can't make these sex hormones. All right, so that would be terrible. So you got to have the right level. So I want you to be able to recognize this molecule here as being a steroid. And steroids can have different forms, like cortisone is a steroid, testosterone, estrogen. Guess what? Another kind of hormone that looks like this steroid right here. It's a female sex hormone. Males only have one sex hormone. Pretty boring. Females have two. Progesterone. Progesterone is going to have that same basic kind of form. So I want you to be able to identify that form. Anytime you see that staircase step, you should say steroid. Okay? And cholesterol is just a precursor to steroids in our body. These are all nonpolar. So where are they going to dissolve? Not in water. They're going to dissolve in some kind of lipid environment in your body. Okay. Another kind of hormone we call prostaglandins. These are modified fatty acids because here I see a nice carboxyl group and it's a big long hydrocarbon chain, but it's been bent in half. It's been folded back on each other. And these are all important signaling molecules, various kinds of prostaglandins in our body that are used for various purposes, but it's still a lipid. So I probably would like for you to recognize this as a lipid, but a prostaglandin in particular. But you don't have to know that this is prostaglandin E1 and this is E2 and this is F1. You should just be able to say, oh, that's a prostaglandin, because it looks like a fatty acid that's done what? Bent in half, bent back on itself. Okay. All right, another kind, and we're going to stop real soon. So we talked about carbohydrates, we talked about lipids. Here are proteins. That's the third kind. And these are amino acids. So an acid, what kind of functional group produces acidity? We just looked at that today, so I don't know if you have it on the tip of your tongue, but a carboxyl group. A carboxyl group is this one right here, CO2 and an H. That's a carboxyl group, right? So an amino acid is an acid. We also call this an amino acid because what is NH2? That's an amino group, so amino acid. And in the very center of an amino acid, we call this the alpha carbon. So every amino acid has a carboxyl group and an amino group and this alpha carbon, and then this right here is an R. This could be various kinds of compounds. So 20 different kinds of amino acids, that R is going to look different. And you're not going to have to memorize amino acids by their name and what the functional group is in this position right here. But here I see a CH and then two CH3s. That's what we call valine. Here's one that has this big cyclic region right here. That's tyrosine. Right, here's one that has a sulfhydryl group on it. That's cytosine. And arginine has a bunch of amino groups on it, so it's basic. Here's one that has a carboxyl group, so it's very acidic. That's called aspartic acid. So all 20 different amino acids have different side groups right at this position, but exactly analogous in this amino group and carboxyl group right here, and always a hydrogen right here. That's an amino acid. So when we put amino acids together, what do we get? We get a protein, okay? And how do we put amino acids together? What kind of reaction? Dehydration synthesis, so what would we pull off? An OH from one amino acid and an H from the neighboring amino acid, that's a dehydration synthesis, and now we have a nice strong, what we call peptide bond between amino acids. They're actually kind of difficult to digest. Peptide bonds are very strong bonds compared to the other bonds that we saw. Okay. All right, so here we see some strong peptide bonds. So here is the first amino acid, here's the second amino acid, here's the third, and here's the fourth. Right, and so we have three peptide bonds that are formed, so three water molecules come off, so that's a dehydration synthesis reaction as well. Just like what we saw for formation of triglycerides and polysaccharides. If we have a chain of, well, I guess I'll go back over here. So what is a protein? It's just a long link, a long thread of amino acids joined one next to the other, next to the other, next to the other. There's very little branching with proteins. So if you're going to think of a protein, probably it's best to think of it as a chain, like a chain that you're wearing around your neck. Not a thread, but a chain. And each link in a chain corresponds to what in a protein? Try to get that model in your mind. Each link in the chain around your neck corresponds to what in a protein? One amino acid. That's right. And if you add a link in your chain gets longer. If you add an amino acid to a protein, it gets what? Longer. Okay. So that's basically all that a protein is. Just a bunch of amino acids put together. And after this, I'm going to stop. If we have a bunch of amino acids put together, less than 100 of them, it's called a polypeptide. And if it's greater than 100 amino acids put together, then we call it a protein. And then for the last quiz, I could ask you, what kind of enzyme breaks down a protein? What are you going to do? You're going to take the substrate name, which is protein, and put what on the end of that word? You're going to put ASE on the end of it. So a protease is an enzyme that breaks down proteins. What does a protease break down a protein into? What's the building block? Amino acid. And what's the reaction? If you build a protein by adding amino acids together with a dehydration synthesis reaction, how do you break a protein apart with a protease? That would be a hydrolysis reaction. Hydrolysis, the breaking of water down. Okay? All right, so I guess that's probably enough for tonight. So remind me to start on 47. No, 48.
Sorry.
Okay. 48 next time. Yeah, we'll start here next time.
Okay.
I mean, I'll go back just a little bit. I don't know. This is maybe part of it. Yeah, I don't know why I don't have that one. No sign-in sheet for tonight, I'm sorry. For some reason, I forgot sign-in sheets for all my classes. None for today. Right. If you missed last time, you're unlucky. Let's see if we can find it right here, okay?
Okay.
So I turn that screen off because I don't want everybody to see. And I might have to turn it back on because I don't know if I can see this screen. My cursor isn't working. I need the internet. And let's see if I have a link to where I need to go. I need to go to a place called Webstar or my gateway.
I think you did do Cypress College.
Yeah, that works real nice. I don't see Cypress College on here anywhere. Oh, I can't.
Edu.
Yeah. I just didn't want to type all that, so I thought Google would work for me. Okay, this is looking pretty good. Oh, no, that's not it. That's sort of it. But wait, do you see homepage?
Nope, that's not it.
Oh my God.
There, go to that next one where it says "Welcome to Cypress College" down there online.
Nope, oh, yeah. Oh, this is good. Someplace over here is Gateway.
Yeah, right there.
Is that where I want to go? Yeah, I think that's it. That's where I want to go. And then I think I want to go over here. Here. Faculty and advisors. Principal attendance roster. And this class, fall to down there. Okay, we're almost there. And then this class is a physiology class.
Yeah,
I think that's it.
I think that's it.
I think that's it. Oh, and then I gotta hit submit. Okay, so do you have a piece of paper? Because you need that number too. So the number, and that's a really small number. 12686. So that's called the CRN number. So the first number you need is, the first number you need is bio 241.
868? Because that's what it is. Write in CRN number.
It is 868. 12868.
Okay, I have that.
Okay, and don't forget then the bio 241. So your ad code.
I typed in 1935, and it didn't work.
Maybe I gave it away to somebody already. So yours is going to be 2249. 2249. Okay. Yeah.
I was laughing because I went in, and I was like, I don't think that's right. And so I typed it in, and it was like English, like something. And I was like, that's the right class.
Which one did I give you before?
Oh, you gave me like, it was 1935.
Oh, I gave it already away. Oh yeah, I gave it to Stephanie. Sorry about that.
It's okay. I was just laughing. I was like, oh no, I can't enter the class because I thought it shut off on me.
Yeah.
And so I freaked out. So.
Sorry about that.
No worries. And
okay.
I was going to email you back, but it was last night when I was trying to add it, and then I worked all day today and come straight here, so.
I think it's going to work.
Yeah, it should.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Doesn't, email me right away.
Okay.
Okay, see ya.
Thanks. Thank you.
Boss. How's it going? I think that's it for Thursday for me.
For Thursday?
Yeah. No, for Tuesday. Oh, God, I wish it was Thursday. I thought I could trick you to not coming in tomorrow.
For me and for you.
For you. Because I don't think I have to come in Friday this week.
You do?
I don't think, and no, I don't.
You did last week?
No, but the next week I do. And then after that, probably a division meeting or something.
Well, next week is the next week B division
meeting.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. So curriculum that should be flushed through the system by the division meeting.
Flushed
through the department scrutiny.
Yeah.
Right on.
No, I haven't seen it.
Are you teaching any classes this semester? No.
No, not for probably till my kids are older, probably.
Yeah.
Because I really kind of have to do that in the evening, otherwise I'm substituting.
Yeah, and I'm not doing some duties with them.
I have to go cancel a class. I feel like such a heel.
Yes, that's too bad. Is it a biology class?
No.
Okay.
Well, that's good.
That's good. Well, no, but then they come to me and want to. I even got ads from biology class, that one that was canceled.
Oh, really?
So students, if they can't get into that one, they want to get into other classes.
Anatomy?
It was the 160.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, see ya. Be gentle. Nah.
Nah.
About time.
Yeah.
To take off. Yeah. Have a nice evening.
All right.
See ya. Forgot I had a package.
Oh yeah, I was gonna say, I saw that.
Some packages are better than others. Maybe this is a good one. Oh, this might be actually a really excitable kind of item, not a book.
Oh.
I think this is a grant that the foundation fund thing.
Oh, let me know if it is, like, and that's what you received it. Who was that from?
Speech Recognition Solutions. Did Allison ever get hers?
Yeah, we're working on it right now. That was a fiasco. I have to get a check and go to the store and buy it.
I can't open it up.
You can't?
No.
You want scissors?
Yeah.
They're kind of dull, but they're
better than a key. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So this was...
I can't tell you if it's going to work or not, but... I can tell you if it's all in here. Lucky. Okay, here's the Zoom switch. That's part of the kit. And then here is the microphone. Holy cow, I got it all. That's everything. Yeah.
Is this the same thing on this? What's this supposed to mean?
said you were up for Bluetooth and you got denied microphone.
Yep, but then they changed their mind.
Who's
oh,
they?
Okay, then I'm going to erase
Foundation.
Oh, well, very good then.
So I don't know how this goes, but it goes like this somehow.
Stick it in your ear.
Stick it in your ear and okay. Act like the Jetsons.
Okay.
Hi, call me George. You have found some free time. Sweet. Yeah, so I hope you guys get something like this. Mm-hmm. To work with your telephone.
Yeah, we definitely need something like that. That's crazy.
Right. Because you can ask if you want. All right, well, I'm going to lock this
okay,
lock this up in a cabinet.
All
kill it. You can't kill it with like an antibiotic that we can for bacteria.